Guess we're supposed to get started. I'm going to give the same preface I gave last week, which is that this is a sort of ridiculous Sunday school class. And so I don't know if it'll be interesting or not. I hope so. I was talking to a former teacher about it, and they told me not to introduce my lessons that way. But I feel just in the need to be honest with you, I don't know how this is going to go. Let me give a little bit of background for this. So some of you know, during seminary, I started to develop an interest in early church. It was more around early church liturgy. And after, to sort of give a compressed history, the last year of seminary, after a lot of thought and a lot of prayer, decided I wasn't going to look for a pastoral position after graduating. I was going to seek to do further academic work and then maybe look for a pastoral position afterwards. While I was meeting with one of my professors, Jack Collins, about that, he said, "Hey, I just got this email from this church that's looking for a youth pastor." And I was like, "I don't know." And I talked to the senior pastor, and he assured me it was a 3-year position, and then I could go on and do further studies in the academy after 3 years. So that was 11 or 12 years ago. And obviously, things have developed differently. But while I was thinking about that, one of the things I was looking at was a PhD program that I'm not sure if it exists anymore, actually, but for a while there was a patristics department and PhD program at Wheaton College, and it was one of the few in the evangelical church. Most of them were in Catholic or Orthodox churches. And so thinking more about that, wanting to talk to some students in that program, I went to that last year in Chicago. They had the annual meeting of the North American Patristic Society, which is unfortunately does have the acronym NAPS in its name, which is how some might feel about it, but I thought it was great. So I went to this conference and got to talk to some students, got to hear different professors and scholars and students reading different papers, which is what would typically happen at these academic conferences. And as I looked at the list, I saw that one of the papers being read was called Holy Hair, and it was on pastoral beards. And I was like, I'm trying to remember the timeline, if I really had the long one at this time, but I was like, I have to go to this. I must know what this is about. And so I went, and it was fantastic, at least to me. And later, I don't even remember what prompted it, but I reached out to the guy who had read the paper and asked if I could have his you know, whatever version he had of it or his notes. And he told me at that point it had been published in St. Vladimir's Theological Quarterly. And so he sent me the published version. I very much enjoyed reading it and thought I should really just teach a Sunday school class on this one day. So that's what I'm doing this morning. Now, you might ask why now, and there's a few reasons, but I'll say one of them is that, you know, it's an awkward position, and was for years, to think of teaching on this subject as a bearded pastor when our very, you know, rightly respected pastor emeritus is not bearded, and coming to you teaching on the subject with a beard could seem to bias me. And so now, as I come to you with just a mustache, I feel like I'm sort of occupying a third spot and can speak about the bearded and the beardless with some more objectivity. So hopefully it will be an objective presentation. Silly as this sounds, I do think we have a number of practical applications for us that this will have, though it may not be the ones that the church fathers will quote had hoped we'd make, but I think there's still some good applications for us. So the context of all of this is, in 1054, and I'll say more about this in a minute, in the Great Schism between the Eastern and Western churches, there were lists of reasons that were given as to why the churches were splitting, why they were fighting with each other, why they were, anathematizing each other, why they were unfaithful. There were several items included, but among them on the list again and again, particularly as an accusation coming from the Eastern Church, was the accusation of clerical beardlessness in the West, that the pastors shaved their faces and that this was a serious issue. So that's what this, the background to that is what this paper is addressing. The full title is Holy Hair, Beards in the Patristic Tradition. It's by Edward, I'm going to try to pronounce his name and go with Szyszynski. Don't know how accurate that is and don't remember how it was pronounced. But I'm going to be summarizing and just reading from this. It looks back at the fathers. So this is mainly, more of a book report of an article. But I do think it has some things for us. I haven't timed this for how it actually all fits in the frame, but hopefully we'll We'll cram it all in there. Let me start with just reading his introduction. He writes, "Although the patristic attitude towards beards may sound like a rather frivolous subject for academic exploration, the father's opinion of facial hair was an important, if now forgotten, component in the dialogue between Christian East and West during most of the Middle Ages. Since the 9th century, many Orthodox Christians maintained that among the reasons for breaking communion with the Church of Rome was the Latin practice of allowing their clergy to go beardless, a practice they believed to be condemned by the canons and the writings of the fathers. The charge of clerical beardlessness is seen as early as the Photin Schism, which was in 863, appears in over half the Byzantine lists of Latin errors, and was among the reasons cited by both Latins and Greeks for the excommunication of 1054. While modern scholars have tended to see this as a cultural difference masking as a theological one, or as one scholar put it in her book, another instance of differences which were not originally religious, gaining religious significance as the conflict between East and West heated up, the Byzantines believed otherwise. Polemical writings from the 11th century onwards maintained that a beardless clergy was not only a clear Judaizing tendency within Latin Christianity, and we'll get to how strange that charge is in a few minutes, but it violated the apostolic institutions and the ancient canons. This was a serious charge, for as was the case with other issues that divided them, the testimony of the common fathers and doctors of the church was the glue holding together the two halves of Christendom. Despite their different readings and interpretations of that witness, both Latins and Greeks believed themselves bound to it, which is why the father's views on facial hair were of great importance. But was there anything in the patristic corpus or the ancient canons that the subject of beards might have theologically justified the Greek position? Or are scholars correct, and this is just another instance of the Byzantine polemicists citing the ancient canons to demonstrate the heretical nature of their Latin counterparts? This paper intends to explore the question by examining the topic of beards in the patristic tradition in order to see what the fathers wrote about them, positively or negatively, and what theological significance, if any, they attached to them. By analyzing the writings of the fathers and the canonical collection of the early church, we will be able to ascertain whether the Byzantines were substantively correct in holding that a beardless clergy violated the ancient canons and the teachings of the church fathers. So that's what he's getting at. The paper, he then goes on to clarify, is narrow in its scope. He's not going to get into general cultural trends when it comes to beards or beardlessness. He's going to focus just on how it took place in terms of pastors in the church. If you're coming in late with no context, I'm sorry. This hopefully will make sense eventually. But the paper, he said, is also going to focus on the patristic period. It came up in debates beyond the patristic period. He doesn't go there. I haven't done extra research to find out myself. But it continued to come up beyond 1054. He gives one example, just to show us. One example from the West, he says, is the fact that the great Cardinal Bessarion might have been elected pope in 1455, except for the refusal to shave his Greek beard, which shows how important a few whiskers can be. He adds in a footnote, according to contemporary sources, when Bessarion began to emerge as a frontrunner to replace the deceased Pope Nicholas V, Cardinal Alain of Avignon stood up and exclaimed, "Shall we elect for a pope, for the head of the Latin Church, a Greek, a mere interloper? Bessarion still wears his beard, and forsooth is he to be our Lord?" It's the forsooth that really gets it there. Szynki adds, however, this paper will presently strictly limit itself to the patristic period and whether or not there ever existed a consensus among the church fathers on the subject of facial hair. So that's what he's looking at. He writes, it should be admitted at the outset that beards came into the Christian world with a heavy baggage of prehistoric and classical symbolism of which the church fathers were not aware. But the symbolism was often dependent on time and place. So he talks about a few things. How in some cultures, shaving off the beard was a sign of grief. In others, the presence of the beard was a particularly focus of maturity and growth. Still in other places, and as we different times have seen in our culture, the growing of a beard or the shaving of it was sometimes seen as an indication of social inclusion or exclusion. So his point being, in different cultures, it often signified different things. He writes, simply put, growing or shaving the beard had a variety of meanings in the ancient world, and this lack of consistency is sometimes reflected in the writing of the fathers on the subject. Among the Greek-speaking fathers, the one who spoke most directly to the topic of facial hair was Clement of Alexandria, who on several occasions spoke of the majesty and manliness of the beard. So Clement of Alexandria, a church father in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, he taught at the catechetical school of Alexandria. Origen was one of his pupils. Szinky goes on, Clement, as was the current in many parts of the empire during the 2nd and 3rd centuries, equated beardlessness, as well as styled long hair, a topic often discussed in conjunction with beards, with either youthful beauty or effeminacy. For that reason, men who shaved or adorned their hair were thought to have done so for one of two reasons, both of which were equally condemned. If it is to attract men, he writes, it is an act of an effeminate person. If to attract women, it is the act of an adulterer. Elsewhere he writes, like one who judges people by their foreheads, he will divide them, these men who shaved, to be adulterous and effeminate. Living for unholy acts of audacity, these fickle wretches do reckless and nefarious deeds. Although he condemned adulterers and those who tried to hide their age due to vanity with things like dyeing their hair, which he also condemns, Szinky goes on, it was upon the issue of effeminacy that Clement focused. How womanly, he argued, for one who is a man to comb himself and shave himself with a razor for the sake of fine effect, to arrange his hair at the looking glass, to shave his cheeks, pluck his hairs out of them and smooth them. And in truth, unless you saw them naked, you would suppose them to be women. Men who behaved this manner, he explained, we ought not to call such as these men, but lewd wretches and effeminate, whose voices are feeble and whose clothes are womanish both in feel and in dye. Clement concluded, and in this he was not alone, Szinky writes, that these men had acted thus because they'd chosen to play the role of a woman in the sexual sphere. For he writes, he who in the light of day denies his manhood will prove himself manifestly a woman by night. So, strong words from Clement of Alexandria on this topic. One concern he voices is vanity. He talks about that. The second concern he talks about, and this will come up again and again, would seem to be sexually. A man, Clement of Alexandria argues, would not shave his beard, it seems, unless he was either trying to attract women in an adulterous way or trying to attract men in an unchaste way. Either way, he sees it as an act of unchastity. But then third, Clement goes on to argue that men shaving their face was also unnatural. And so, Szinky writes, Clement held that Christian men were called to follow the natural way. In other words, that they were called by God to behave and look like men, including, he argued, the maintenance of a manly beard. For this reason, he wrote, this then, the mark of the man, the beard, by which he is seen to be a man. In this, God deemed it right that he would excel and dispersed hair over man's whole body. Whatever smoothness and softness was in him, he abstracted from his side when he formed the woman Eve. While he, for he parted with all smoothness, remained a man and shows himself a man. It is therefore impious to desecrate the symbol of manhood, which Clement identifies as hairiness. But the very hairs of your head are numbered, says the Lord. Those on your chin too, he adds, are numbered, and those on your whole body. There must be therefore no plucking out contrary to God's appointment, which has counted them and according to his will. A little later he writes, God wishes women to be smooth and rejoice in their locks alone, growing spontaneously as a horse in his mane, but has adorned man like the lion with a beard and endowed him as an attribute of manhood with shaggy breasts, a sign of his strength and rule. Szinky writes, since this was the way of nature and thus God's will, Clement argued that it's not lawful to pluck out the beard, man's natural and noble adornment, for just as a lion glories in his shaggy hair and boars even are made imposing by their mane, men are called to glory in their hair. It is the beard by which he is anointed, on which he descended the prophetic ointment, which Aaron was honored. So there is, again, a little more from Clement, more strong words about the call of what is natural. Others outside the church made similar arguments at this time, which we have some indication. This is a cultural argument, particularly in the East, that's coming up. One example Szyszynski cites, I wish he had an easier name, is Julian the Apostate, who was obviously not a Christian, but also a cultural influence at the time, who defended beards. He actually wrote a work called The Beard Hater. Opposing those who hated beards in his mind. So it shows up in the culture around. It shows up, though, also in church documents, too. It's not just one or two theologians who go off on this topic. One influential document it shows up in is a document called the Apostolic Constitutions. It's not actually apostolic. It comes together, it seems, in the 4th century, though different parts of it might be from different eras. It was given some serious weight in some parts of the church, though. And it had instruction in it on a number of things, focused on moral conduct, focused on liturgical practices, it focused on church structures and organization. Szyszynski writes that it also provided, among other things, rules to govern relations between the sexes. After enjoining Christian men not to become a scandal to women by making themselves too beautiful, and thus an occasion of sin, the constitutions provided a list of prohibitions that served to keep men from ensnaring women. Prohibited were gold rings, fine shoes, stockings and garments, and of course, long hair. Then the document continues thus, Do not thou permit the hair of thy head to grow too long, but rather cut it short, lest by nicely combing thy hair and wearing it long and anointing thyself, thou draw upon thyself such ensnared or ensnaring women. For it is not lawful for thee, a believer and man of God, to permit the hair of thy head to grow long and to brush it up together, nor to suffer it spread abroad, nor puff it up, nor by nice combing and plaiting to make it curl and shine, since that is contrary to the law, which says thus in its additional precepts, you shall not make yourselves curls, round rasures. As was often the case, the prohibition against long, luxurious hair was then joined with this injunction, nor may men destroy the hair of their beards and unnaturally change the form of a man. For the law says, you shall not mar your beards. For God the Creator has made this decent for women, but has determined that it is unsuitable for men. For if thou do these things to please men, in contradiction to the law, thou wilt be abominable with God, who created thee after his own image. If therefore thou wilt be acceptable to God, abstain from all those things which he hates, and do none of those things that are unpleasing to him. Now, Szyszynski points out it's interesting that the Apostolic Constitutions and others will quote here Leviticus 19:27 for backing, which says, do not cut the hair at the sides of your head nor clip the edges of your beard. Because this, one would think, would be regarded by Christians as part of the ceremonial law that no longer applied directly, or at least literally, to Christians. But the Apostolic Constitutions actually argue that laws like these that are found in Leviticus were not ceremonial laws, but were the laws of nature, and so they remained in effect. So we have Clement of Alexandria, and we have the Apostolic Constitution, but Cyprian of Carthage, another church father, the bishop in North Africa, who was later very influential, also weighed in on this topic. In giving advice to Quirinius on how the God-fearing must act, Cyprian included the injunction that the beard must not be plucked, citing Leviticus as biblical warrant for the teaching. What makes this continued use of Leviticus particularly fascinating is the fact that later Byzantine polemics will identify the Latin practice of shaving as part of some Judaizing purification practice, Judaizing being a common charge they made against the West during this period. And yet, while hurling the accusation at the Latins, they clearly grounded the practice of bearded clergy on Levitical teachings. God commanded the priests to keep their beards, and thus it should always be. Later Byzantine authors then added the charge of effeminacy against the Latins, claiming their priests all shaved their beards and looked like women. We see this going on, but we also see it wasn't just church fathers in the East. And again, Cyprian is in North Africa, not as far east. But we also see in Western church fathers that they talk about the meaning of the beard as well. Augustine was one who did this. So Szyszynski writes, Augustine has maintained that the beard is an essentially useless item, since it serves no real purpose. It was simply for adornment of man. And there's a whole thing in, it's in City of God, where he goes on to sort of talk about the possible usefulness of the beard. And one of the conclusions he makes is that if it was for warmth or protection, then God would have given the beard to women because they're more often cold and need protection. And since he gave it to men, it must just be, as he puts it, for adornment and for beauty. So Augustine talks about it in City of God. He talks about it also, though, in his exposition of the Psalms. Szyszynski writes, it was Augustine who, in his exposition of the Psalms, provided one of the most detailed explanations of the meaning of the beard, both societally and theologically. Commenting on Psalm 132, verse 2, it is like precious oil poured on the head, running down on the beard, running down on Aaron's beard, down upon the collar of his robes. Augustine wrote that just as the oil poured on Aaron's head onto his beard, so too the grace of the Holy Spirit is poured from Christ, the head, onto the beard, the apostles. For he writes, the beard is a sign of strong men. A beard is typical of young, vigorous, energetic, eager people. That's why we say he's a bearded fellow when we describe someone of this character. The apostles and martyrs, he goes on to argue, fortified against persecutions are like the beard anointed with oil. They suffered but were not overcome, allowing the oil to flow down upon the tunic, which Augustine argued is the church. Szyszynski notes that both Prosper of Aquitaine and Cassiodorus follow Augustine, writing that we do well to interpret the beard as the apostles here, for a beard is the mark of forceful manliness, remaining immovable below the head. So you have these arguments, or these at least frameworks from Augustine, but that said, it wasn't really this symbolism, Szyszynski notes, that was the driving force behind these debates, but he notes that it was a preoccupation with Christian modesty that governed much of the father's thinking concerning both hair and beards, especially in the West. Tertullian was among the many fathers who equated shaving with the excessive and sinful desire to adorn the body in order to lure the opposite sex. But also then, he notes, in the West, some church leaders had concerns that it wasn't clean-shavenness, but rather beards that might inappropriately lure women. And he cites here Jerome. He writes, Jerome warned against those who claimed to minister to women while loaded with chains and wearing their hair long like women, contrary to the apostles' precepts, not to speak of beards like those of goats. He adds, all these things are tokens of the devil. So strong words from Jerome with concerns about beards. Elsewhere, he goes on to warn about those who have long beards and claim to be holy men, but really are luring women to themselves. Beyond Jerome, we can look at John Chrysostom then, who warned of men who grew long philosophers' beards in order to deceive others about his holiness. He compares them to being nothing more than an actor on a stage, and that's sort of part of his costume. And instead, Chrysostom wrote, Christian philosophers, true lover of wisdom, on the contrary, bidding farewell to staff and beard and other accoutrements, have their souls adorned with doctrines of true philosophy. And not only with doctrines, but also with real practice. Szyszynski writes, interestingly, the thinking behind Chrysostom and Jerome's anti-beard stance and the pro-beard stance of Clement, Cassiodorus, Tertullian, and Cyprian is remarkably similar. For all concerned, the concern that was at issue was not the beard itself, but rather the message that it sent. So first, he notes that for both, there was this goal of Christians and Christian leaders contrasting themselves with pagan hypocrites. But second, again, this concern comes up again and again on both sides of this concern of drawing upon oneself ensnared or ensnaring women. He writes, if Clement, Tertullian, and Cyprian condemned the beardless man for trying to appear more tempting to the opposite sex, Jerome condemned the bearded one. The real issue was not facial hair, he notes, but chastity. So we have these things that are all going around, these accusations going back and forth. What complicates the picture further, he points out, was that early on, beards were associated with monasticism. Though later this would change in the West, and we'll get to that. One of the restrictions, one of the monastic laws in a lot of places was that a man had to be old enough to grow a beard in order to join a monastery. So that was one thing they would be looking for those who would join. Then beards were often associated, particularly with the desert fathers early on in the monastic movement. And a hermit's beard was often seen as a sign of his renunciation of the world and his monastic life. It was often given as part of the description of him and of how he was living. Yet, Sosinke writes, there were still those who did not necessarily equate the beard with holiness, and we have the example of Apollonius, who scolded severely those who let their beard and hair grow long. He used to say, it is certain that these people are seeking praise from human beings, and they are letting their beard and hair grow long to show off, even though we are commanded to celebrate even our fasts in private. If a beard could make one blessed, the ancient saying goes, no one would be holier than a goat. So you have, again, you see this back and forth where it's this view of no beard show that you're going out, you're a hermit, you're renouncing the world, to no, now a beard is a sign of pride. You're growing it to show how holy you are, and so beards are bad. And then this starts to come into actual canons of the church, this topic. We have church canons related to beards, and the history there gets actually even weirder. He writes, among the earliest canons dealing specifically with beards was the 5th century Statua Ecclesiae Antiqua, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, which mandated that the cleric shall not let his hair grow, neither shall he shave his beard. Ironically, Sosinke continues, this canon actually became the basis for later Western legislation against beards, as the Latin word, one of the Latin words in that sentence at some point went missing from Latin manuscripts, so that now it read, the cleric shall not let his hair grow, nor his beard, saying the opposite now. According to Giles Constable, how and when this happened remains a mystery, although the evidence suggests that the medieval copyists removed, or perhaps one should say shaved off, the Latin word in order to conform with later Western practice. So these are the kinds of jokes you get in academic papers. So you have that happen with one, and then actually the same thing happens with another early church canon. The Council of Barcelona, the First Council of Barcelona, in the year 540, in its third canon, repeated what we saw in the earlier canon, prohibiting shaving and long hair. He adds, in this case, it was probably done because Spain at the time was being overrun by Visigoths and other barbarians wearing long beards, whom it was the clergy's primary duty to convert to Christianity. No wonder that bishops ordered the clergy to adopt, as far as possible, their way of living. However, by the 9th century, the canon read differently. Now, the canon was, again, not in an official way revised, but in later manuscripts, it suddenly read, no cleric shall grow his hair or beard, but instead shall shave, saying the opposite. And it was in this form that it was then cited by later popes to support the Western practice of clerical shaving. He writes, although these early canons seem to support a bearded clergy, neither of the two canons is known to have any real influence in its original form. Instead, he says, there is ample evidence that beardlessness was the norm among the Latin clergy, who simply adopted the norms of Roman society and thus shaved their beards. Later canons merely enforced a practice that had already become accepted custom, using a corrupted version of those two canons to give them the veneer of antiquity and authority. Canons explicitly forbidding long hair were then interpreted to prohibit both long hair and beards, the growth of either punishable by anathema. In the end of the patristic, by the end of the patristic era in the West, beardlessness, especially among the clergy, was well ensconced. So again, you have this weird history of there actually being canons requiring beards. Then copyists in the West just changed it to reflect what priests were doing and requiring them to shave. And the later justification for having pastors shave than in the West was developed from two different sources. He says the first was the ongoing concern that priests and religious should comport themselves in a manner consistent with religious life. Modesty and chastity, especially for the clergy, remained paramount. So just a general sense, as we see an opposite to the Eastern Church in the West, was this is how a pastor or a monk is modest, is by shaving. The second reason was theological, though, and it concerned the legend of St. Peter's tonsure. According to the tradition, attested to as earlier as Gregory of Tours, so in the 6th century, St. Peter, in order to teach humility, had his head shaved by those who did not believe his word, as if in mockery. Although the beard isn't explicitly mentioned in the early forms of this legend, its removal was soon understood to be part of St. Peter's tonsure. It was not uncommon then in certain parts of Western Europe to see Peter portrayed as both having a tonsure, that top part of the hair removed, and also St. Peter being seen beardless. By the 7th century, when we begin to see legislation in the West mandating tonsures, understood as the cutting of both the hair and the beard, specific reference was often made to Peter's example. When the East began to question the practice of a beardless clergy in the 9th century, the Carolingians could and did claim that the practice, their practice, of shaving beards was actually apostolic, referencing the blessed Apostle Peter and also the many other disciples and apostles who were called to cut both beard and head. All right, so where are we going with this all? So we get to Szyszynski's conclusion now, and I'll read from his conclusion, and I'll try to draw a few applications and conclusions of my own. So Szyszynski writes, "Having examined the subject of beards in the writings of the fathers, we are now in a position to answer the question posed at the beginning of this paper. In other words, did the canons and patristic tradition, as the Byzantine polemicists later claimed, support the idea of a bearded clergy?" He writes, "The answer, perhaps surprisingly, is yes. The evidence strongly suggests that there was indeed a patristic consensus on the matter of facial hair, and that it did, with some qualifications, favor the beard. However, before granting victory to the Orthodox in their millennia-long battle with the West on this matter, a few words of explanation are probably in order. It is true that beards were not one of the subjects upon which the fathers wrote a great deal, especially when compared to the more pressing theological, pastoral, and ecclesial issues with which they were usually preoccupied. However, they did have cause to speak of beards. When they did, the fathers, with few exceptions, spoke about them in a positive light. Beards were manly, a sign of virtue and strength, man's natural adornment akin to the lion's mane. Conversely, shaving off the beard was a sign of effeminacy, associated with unnatural behaviors, the loss of comeliness, or sinful self-adornment. While the practice of the early church was not always uniform and depended often enough on changing cultural norms, the patristic corpus as it comes down to us points to the view that the ancient church generally encouraged its members, clergy and lay, to be bearded rather than beardless." So again, as we saw, some of the concern of this was this sense of natural order and the natural role of beards. Others had to do with concerns of men shaving in order to behave like women sexually. But a third issue that we see also was vanity. Well, let me see my order here. My notes are a little unclear. Okay. So a third issue was vanity. Though some accused those who shave as being vain, we also saw that there were some, particularly in the West, who accused those who grew a long beard as doing it out of vanity. A fourth concern mentioned is the concern of men trying to ensnare women. But again, we saw this in both directions. The apostolic constitution suspected that those who shaved were trying to ensnare women, while Jerome expressed his suspicion that those who grew long, impressive beards were trying to lure women. Szyszynski notes that at root, it's vanity and lust that are really in view here. He writes, Greek cultural assumptions about beardlessness, which were themselves completely non-theological, played an important role in these later polemical attacks, just as they had during the patristic period. When Clement and the other fathers condemned the removal of the beard, it was not because they believed it to be holy or imbued by God with an inherent theological significance. On the contrary, the evidence suggests that beardlessness is condemned only to the extent that it had implication for Christian morality, especially as it concerned sexual behavior. Sexual immorality is condemned, and beardlessness only condemned in so much as it was a sign of this lifestyle. So, in truth, while both arguments, though especially the East's argument for beards, grew into passions and condemnations in the end, in truth, Szinski argues that the East likely lost track even of where the call for clerical beards had originated. Meanwhile, the East was also accusing the West of Judaizing when they shaved, which was an even stranger accusation to make, as it was the East that was citing the Old Testament ceremonial law to support their practice. Szinski concludes, however, the truth remains that the Byzantine beard had strong patristic and canonical support, even if the Byzantines themselves had forgotten both where it came from and the reasons behind it. Even in the Latin West, the earliest known canons on the subject of beards originally encouraged their growth, despite the later alterations as practice shifted in the post-patristic period. The fathers, by and large, preferred a man with a beard. That said, what should be remembered is that both the Latin custom of maintaining beardless clergy and the Byzantine practice were ultimately grounded on the same underlying principles that guided the patristic teaching, that Christians in clerical appearance should encourage the virtues of modesty and chastity, never giving rise to scandal or temptation. This was the true message of the fathers when it came to beards, and one which, despite the differences in both Catholic and Orthodox Christians, continue to share. For Christian men, and especially for the clergy, the question of whether to grow or shave the beard is completely secondary to the primary goal of maintaining one's holiness, modesty, and virtue. For the fathers, East and West alike, a holy priest was far more pleasing to God than a hairy one. And that's how Szinski ends his article. So what do we do with all this? Let me suggest sort of 7 points of application for us. Sorry. I found it very meaningful. You may not have. You may be wondering what you just did with the last half hour of your life. But 7 things I think this means for us. One, is the importance of focusing on actual holiness over specific non-biblically commanded practices. Again, it's that final point that Szinski makes, that really what they were trying to aim for was chastity, modesty, and rejecting vanity. The beard was a secondary means to an end, but at a certain point in the debate, the beard, the practice, the thing that was supposed to be an aid in one direction or the other, became the focus. And we can see it really, it's, you know, if you think of C.S. Lewis's essay on old books, that when you read things from other periods, you can see more clearly what they were maybe blind to. We can see more clearly, I hope, that your takeaway is, we can see more clearly that this was an absurd thing to get this worked up about. But Lewis's point is we have our own things where we shift from the actual goals, the virtues we're aiming for, we shift to some specific non-biblical commandment that we then make the marker of whether we're pursuing those goals. And then we fight about the marker. We make accusations about the marker. So we need to be aware of that tendency to focus on that instead of the actual issue we're aiming for or the virtue we're aiming for. Second, and related to that, is to be really careful to note the difference between wise caution on one end and what we would call hedging the law on the other end. Wise caution calls us to look at things and say, okay, we want to avoid this sin, we want to pursue this virtue, what are the means to get there? How do I avoid the means that might lead me to temptation? How do I pursue the means that would lead me to greater virtue? That's wisdom. The Bible talks about that. You know, it talks about don't go down the street where you know you're going to be tempted by the adulteress in Proverbs, things like that. So that's wise caution in seeking to live virtuously. But hedging the law is when we add to the law and we take specific requirements that aren't biblical and we treat them as if they are part of the law. We see them as wise, and they're not just for certain people or certain situations, but we make them part of what everyone's supposed to do, and we treat violating them as if they are themselves sin. And I think it's interesting to think about that tendency, especially on the topics at work here. The topics in this article have to do with gender and modesty and chastity and virtue. And those are areas where we may be particularly prone to adding to God's law beyond what's there. When we see in the Bible the group, the party, the argument that wants to and advocates for adding to God's law in order to prevent people from sinning is the Pharisees. We generally don't want to follow their example, but when we're not thinking about it, it's very tempting to start adding to it and treating those things we add as if they're part of God's law. That's in some ways fairly obviously what happened here. In a right pursuit maybe of their perceptions of what could lead towards sin, and maybe did in their culture, they made extra laws and then treated those who broke those laws as if they had violated God's law. So that's a second application for us. We need to be careful about those distinctions for ourselves and for how we think about other people. A more specific form of that probably, which just struck me as I read this, was we need to beware of making non-biblical laws, particularly when it comes to issues of gender expression and differentiation. And, there's sort of classic things people will cite. And, in one culture, you have the skirt as the sign of what's feminine. Then you go to another and it's a kilt and it's a sign of what's masculine. We see that in this article we just heard from as it has to do with beards. And the Bible is clear that the genders are to be differentiated. But what that looks like from one culture to another, what it looks like from one generation to another can shift. And as I read the sort of statements of just how unmasculine anyone who shaves is from Clement of Alexandria, I thought of blog posts I've read in the past that were pushing for certain things, that this is what real men do. And if you're not doing this, even though there's not really a biblical argument for it, if you're not doing this thing, you're not really a man. We have those arguments that go around in our circles. It's helpful to think that maybe a few centuries from now, people will read those and they might sound as goofy as these arguments about how effeminate any man who shaves is. So we need to be aware of making those non-biblical laws specifically when it comes to issues of gender. Fourth point of application for us is to beware of historical arguments without context or if we haven't checked the other person's work. Historical arguments are super fun because you can have something you like and then you can argue that whoever your shared agreed upon people are, like for us it's usually the reformers, just like for them it was the fathers. If you can say they're in your corner, then it feels great. And you could be like, well, you're disagreeing with not just me, but John Calvin. So, take that. And they're often much, not always, of course, the reformers, the fathers, they had views. You can find them. They're readily available. Most people don't actually look that much because what we want is more a soundbite than an actual understanding of who would support who. And we saw this in this article, right? So both the East and the West at a certain point claimed that they had apostolic support for their views on something as, trivial as clerical beards. In the West, we saw that they were appealing to this legend of Peter, the Apostle Peter, being shaved and tonsured to show a sign of humility. So they were saying, we're following the Apostle Peter's example. That was in the West. The East was appealing to this document, the Apostolic Constitutions, as their evidence for a bearded clergy. Neither had apostolic support, like at all. Both were very confident they did. Both were cherry-picking things and giving them more weight than they should have and taking them out of context in certain ways, too. And we have a tendency to do this. I mentioned my academic interest in liturgy, and it's one of the things that is just notorious in liturgical studies, is the person who has a certain view, and then they go searching in history to show that this is what the church has always done, and they cherry, or at least the church in the right period, whatever their golden era is of church history, they're going to show that's they did what they like now. So Anglican liturgical scholars look back and they find Anglicanism in the early church. Presbyterians find Presbyterian practices, Catholics find Catholics and practices, and so on. It's not that the work can't be done objectively, it's just that if we're not careful, we have a tendency to look for proofs for our preferences instead of actually get an understanding of the history. Another example of this that comes to more weighty matters, I mentioned a church history professor I had in college who I particularly enjoyed, and one of his arguments in a class on the Reformation was that, you know, one of the things you had happening in the Reformation was you had the Protestants and Catholics both arguing that Augustine was on their side, and then when things cooled down, going back to their corners, and maybe both to a certain extent realizing that Augustine wasn't as much on their side as they had hoped. Not that he didn't say things that would support their view, but, you know, there's a some who have argued the Reformation in many ways was Augustine's views on salvation, his soteriology, doing battle with Augustine's ecclesiology, his view on the church, with the reformers taking up the soteriology, the Catholic Church taking up the ecclesiology. However much you put in that or not, there was a tendency to say, this person's totally on our side. And he was a bit on their side, actually, in some important ways, but it was not as clear-cut, maybe, as they'd want. And history is good. We should look to history for wisdom. We should be careful of historical arguments that we make without getting a picture of the context of those things and without checking the work of other people. Just because someone says a reformer or church father said something doesn't mean that they're summarizing it very well. So beware of that is my fourth application. A fifth would be the importance of not assuming the motives behind other groups' practices. This was kind of the thing at the center of a lot of this, right? Both the East and the West at a certain point became convinced that the other was motivated in their practice by immorality, by vanity, by lust, by pride, by something like that. Again, as we look back with hindsight, I think we can see that their motives they were projecting onto practice were fairly absurd. Again, it's something we do all the time, and you hear it whenever there's a heated theological debate. One side will say, well, you know what they're really trying to do is X. Like, they're saying what they want, you know, is A, but I know what they're up to. Like, they're trying to do X, so we got to stop them. It's really important that we fight about A. And both sides will do it, and there's imputing motives that are, that are both cynical and that are sinister. So, fifth thing is to heed the warning we should see play out here of not assuming the motives behind other practices. A sixth thing is that sometimes the church disputes that seem so important and in which it seems so obvious to us that we are right and other people are just monumentally wrong, sometimes the whole dispute is actually really stupid and wrongheaded. Like, I think we can look back on this and be like, this was pretty dumb. But real polemics were written about this, and I don't think they were faking it. Like, I think they believed that this was both important and that it was really obvious that they had the church fathers and the apostles even maybe on their side. They were fighting for the truth. We need to be aware a little bit that sometimes the things that seem to take on that meaning we're wrong about. We need to step back. Church history, again, is a good way to get some perspective and ask whether or not the matter is as important as it seems to us. Final point of application is that we need to be aware of placing the identity markers, what really is the identity markers of our own cultural or spiritual tribe, over our shared loyalty to Christ as our King. We need to be careful to place some symbol, some marker of our identity, of our own sub-tribe, a spiritual sub-tribe, over our shared loyalty to Christ, our King. We see that play out pretty terribly here. We can see it play out terribly in other parts of church history. And if you weren't at the 8:15, for more on that, you can join us at the 11 o'clock service, where it happens to be the topic of our sermon. So we'll think about those connections between how we view our own cultural and spiritual tribes versus how we view our loyalty to Christ and what that means for how we relate to other Christians who may be different from us or may look different from us, whether it's facial hair or something else. So There's a class on the patristic history of clerical beards. I'm trying to scan. This is the first time you were with us. I'm so sorry, but yeah, Don.
What did they have to say about mustaches?
There's obviously room in this field for more research, so I'll be bringing my proposal to the session to go do a research project, maybe a PhD dissertation on clerical mustaches. I'm so excited to find an area that still needs more work. Yeah.
But it does strike me, I was actually encouraged. Mike Pfefferly, the pastor out of the session, what was labeled, I think, satire, but it was a comment about the Navy blazer that Mike just had been around for elders. And it was really labeled as satire, but it did say about the obligatory Navy blazer as the uniform for a Presbyterian elder. And I think, you know, there is a sense in which
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And I think, you know, part of it, what makes it difficult, if you want to analyze, is that these sorts of things, whether it's, you know, how we shape our appearance one direction or another, they do have meaning. Clothes have meaning, uniforms have meaning. That's why we see uniforms in the Bible. We see them in each culture. So those things have meaning, but you also have the dangers of either overinterpreting those meanings or not recognizing how the marker or the uniform or the style that is supposed to express that meaning can change from one culture to another, as we see that diverge in the East and West here. It can change from one time period to another, as we see that with beards seem to happen in the Western church from earlier on to later on. So those things, it matters what we're communicating, but we have to recognize those things, those meanings change, and as they change, we need to be sensitive to that and not assume we know what the other person is trying to communicate. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I was thinking about, you know, Paul argues, doesn't nature teach you that it's shameful for a man to have long hair? But, I mean, I don't necessarily, to him, I think in his culture alone, that was a given. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how history plays into that, and even what it's associated with out in the non-believing culture, you know, whether it's something they're trying to be connected with or trying to distance themselves from, that can change depending on the context culturally as well. So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
What are your observations just briefly on some of the things today that we're doing just like that, that maybe we can't see because they're...
That's another class. I'm sorry. I don't even know how to, like, I'll think about another class. What are the things we've, and also, like, I don't know, check to see if the video's on or not. Maybe it'll get broken right before I do it, but sorry.
Gender and what was masculine and what was feminine is a long
Yeah, it's a good point that among the things that we see in every age is these sorts of struggles to identify exactly what gender expression should look like or what different meanings have. And I think with that too, at least for me, is, you know, I can read the more condemning or narrow or judgy voices on those sorts of topics in certain places, like on the internet, and be like, oh man, how do we have this here? And it's a reminder that every age has their Clement of Alexandria who's writing things that you read and you're like, oh my goodness, how did he even get there? Has their followers. That's just a thing that happens too. It's both the disputes generally, disputes maybe around gender, and those who take hard lines and those who follow them. It's not a new problem. It's not unique to us, but there's both. Yeah, I think it's just sort of it's not that some strange trial necessarily has come on us. The details might be strange and new. The overall aspects are pretty common and repeating probably. So did I have, let me do one, two, and then we got to end. I got to do a thing at 11. The tucking wars, No, thanks. Last comment here, and then I'll pray for us. Did you want to think?
Just a quick story. Years ago, every place else in Greece, the men were all clean shaven. But the priests were so distinctive, not only in their black robes, but with their beards. It was kind of interesting.
It's interesting how that thing that, was seen as being reflecting a certain cultural aspect now. Instead of now, it is a distinction from the dominant culture. Instead of a thing that's following those patterns. Yeah. So that's interesting. Let me pray for us real quick, and then we'll let folks in here. Lord, as we look at a past dispute this morning that might seem really obscure and a bit silly, we pray that it would be for us a mirror, Lord, that we would reflect on that question that was asked, maybe broadly, but even for ourselves individually. What are those things, Lord, that we get focused on a man-made or a man-made rule or guideline or detail, and that we accuse others who don't follow it of having certain goals, Lord, where we interpret others uncharitably, where we elevate our own thoughts or preferences or cultural practices to the level of your word, Lord. Give us eyes to see those things in our own lives, in our own hearts. Help us, Lord, to then hold those things in a right position, and help us not to divide with our brothers and sisters over things you would not have us divide over, Lord. Help us to place our loyalty to you above all things, and let that be reflected in our words and our thoughts and in our relationships. Lord, help us in this, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.